There's no doubt that the king was central. But the other frequent subject of the palace reliefs and royal documents was the army. Assyrian soldiers are never depicted as injured or in any way harmed by an enemy. It was rare for inscriptions to refer to Assyrian losses. And you might recall Sargon II's arduous battle against Urartu noted that he lost only 5 men in this long battle. Men from all different parts of the empire fought in the army, and we've discussed before that deportees were sometimes assigned to fight in the army. Certain provinces or client states would supply special troops. For example, the Phoenicians were leaders in sea trade from their homeland in Syria across the Mediterranean to Spain. And they were the sole source for the Assyrian navy for much of its rule. There's been a lot of speculation about potential communication or language barriers in an army so big and composed of so many different ethnicities. And we'll see that the Persians also created enormous forces from different regions of the Near East. We have to imagine that there would be translators or native commanders for each squadron of troops. Sieges such as Lachish would require the most manpower and supplies. They were very expensive endeavors. Field battles were not as frequent as we might imagine. The Assyrians really relied on intimidation to try and subdue potential enemies. They would send out large armies to trouble spots and hope that they would surrender. Word would have spread throughout the Near East about what had happened to Assyria's enemies. And one of the features of Assyrian fighting that was most horrific would be the humiliation and desecration of corpses, which would be an important visual reminder if someone was visiting a king's palace or if they had heard what the Assyrian army had done. And this would make it much more likely for a city to think twice about rebelling. Remember that the proper burial close to the family was a common religious tenet in antiquity. A family would need to provide food and drink for the dead. Just as the official texts of Assyrian campaigns listed the number of dead and deported, these scenes seem designed to break the spirit of any enemy before they even face the army. The Assyrian kings emerged in the royal ideology as powerful, decisive men whose actions were approved by their national god. They carried this authority with them on the battlefield. Although, of course, as we've seen, no man in his right mind would challenge the ruler, although the Assyrian king seems to have to face a lot of insane enemies over the course of the first millennium. Not to worry, the victory was assured, at least in the official reports back home, and it would later be carved in stone to inspire respect, fear, and pride in those who visited the king in his palace. In the next lecture, we will discuss the end of the Assyrian Empire. It's going to seem to come unexpectedly. Its last king, Ashurbanipal, was the king who feasted in the garden with his queen while he gazed at the head of one of Assyria's major enemies, the ruler of Elam. When Assyria was defeated, the armies that sacked its royal palaces hacked away the faces of the rulers on many of the relief sculptures that we've discussed today, enacting their own revenge against this great empire of the first millennium.